Tonight on Arena, we have live music with Angie McMahon and Charlene McKenna on her new film, A Greyhound of a Girl. Today marks the release across Ireland and UK cinemas of a beautiful new animated film called A Greyhound of a Girl, which is based on the Roddy Doyle novel of the same name. It has a stellar cast starring the voice talents of BAFTA-winning Sharon Horgan, Oscar nominee Brendan Gleeson and Rosalind Linehan. We join four generations of women as they take a life-affirming journey together, where they gain the opportunity to reconnect and learn more about each other. One of the main characters of this animation is Tansy, who is voiced by the award-winning actress Charlene McKenna, who I'm delighted to say is on the line to tell us more about this new film. Welcome, Charlene, coming loud and clear from Toronto.
I know, I'm beaming in. I feel like I'm on CNN or something. It's like, greetings from Toronto.
So tell us, what are you doing at the other side of the world?
I am just tagging along my husband. He's here filming a new series for the BBC called Lockerbie. So I'm his tag along.
Very nice. Very nice place to be, I'd say.
It's beautiful. I was really trying to get some sun, but I landed to 2 days of rain. But today looks promising.
Now, to talk about A Greyhound of a Girl, without giving too much away, if possible, can you give us the premise of the movie?
These questions are always hard. I think the tagline, you know, it's an exploration of childhood grief. But, I mean, that, not to put anyone off, because it's a wonderful movie. It's filled with humour and sarcasm and, you know, the acerbic Roddy Doyle writing and wit, and it's such a beautiful movie, and I'm so excited that it's finally coming out. It attracts four women across the generations, and it's just about family and love and connection and loss and all the messy, wonderful human emotions.
Right. So we have at the heart of it this young girl called Mary O'Hara. Mm-hmm. And she's pretty cheeky, 12-year-old Dublin girl. And she is great friends with her grandmother. And then a road trip happens. Well, why is that?
Well, so classically, you know, that 12, 13-year-old girl, she's having a real contentious relationship with her mother, voiced by Sharon Horgan, who's amazing. And has turned, you know, is incredibly close to her grandmother, as I think is, if you're blessed, is often the way. And so, without giving too much away, I arrive on the scene, and this four multi-generational road trip ensues with these four women. I don't know how to say more without giving anything away.
I guess we could just say that you're maybe otherworldly or from another time.
Yes, I'm from another time. And we go on this kind of road trip, but it's a sort of a final road trip destination.
Well, look, let's listen to a clip from the film, which has you in it. This is Tansy and Mary, voiced by yourself and the young actress Mia O'Connor. 11-year-old Mary has an insatiable passion for cooking and dreams of becoming a great chef and cook for her grandmother. Your character, Tansy, has joined her in the kitchen.
My granny always says, for a proper cool cannon, you must use Wexford sand.
Sand? I don't see it anywhere.
Every kitchen holds its secrets. Herbs of the seashore.
This will make Granny much better.
That was Charlene McKenna and Mia O'Connor in a clip from A Greyhound of a Girl. So as I said, you're a little old worldly, old being the operative world. You come from a different understanding maybe of the kitchen even than Mary.
Yes, I think the act of cooking was very different the last time Tansy cooked comparative to Mary cooking now. And I think my character's very in awe of how the world has advanced since she's been away.
So, Charlene, how au fait are you with doing animation? Have you voiced animated stuff before?
No, not at all. It's a complete bucket list check moment because I always wanted to. I would love to do more because the freedom in the booth is, I mean, it's just unparalleled. You can be as big as you want. You can go wild. You don't have to care about your hair or your spots. So you can just go nuts. So I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. And I love working with Mia and I love working with Enzo. And it was, it was a really, really fun experience that I would happily do again.
So Enzo is your director and most of your scenes were with Mia O'Connor. So it was just you and Mia in the booths when you were working, let's say, Brendan Gleeson and Sharon Horgan and Rosalind Linehan joined later.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, common. I remember when I first heard that about Shrek, that Eddie Murphy did all of Donkey on his own, and I remember when I heard it, I was really disappointed. I mean, it doesn't affect the movie in the slightest, but I was like, oh, because it seems like they're just bouncing off each other with chemistry. But luckily it was me and Mia, we were together, which I think was important because we could really riff and we could make eye contact with each other, and I think that affords a kind of like a trust and a freedom, which was lovely to have. It was really a lot of fun.
And then you of course have the director Enzo D'Allo who can advise you on, let's say, the tempo and the timbre of your performances.
He can. Enzo is quite fantastically Italian, and he can absolutely direct. He's quite the auteur of animation in Italy. If I could understand him all the time, there's a whole big thing in the movie because it's about cooking, about, you know, this recipe for cold cannon, and Enzo every day was like, "We need to talk about the recipe," and I would be like, "The recipe? What's the recipe? I'm sorry," and he'd be like, "The recipe before the cold cannon." I was like, oh, the recipe. Good old Enzo. He's such a character. He's a wonderful man.
I'm sure he must have been aghast at the makeup of Culcannon, was he, coming from Italy?
I was a bit, because I grew up, it was cabbage, but apparently, and this has been a big debate, and Roddy was, that it's kale. So you can put that to the people of Ireland. Is it kale or cabbage? Because I grew up that it was cabbage. But in the movie, it's the recipe is kale.
All right. I thought it was cabbage too. But maybe, you know, Roddy was thinking about health and kale and, you know, having kale drinks.
Cannon, but apparently it's an old recipe. So you can take that up with Roddy.
So when you look at, did you know what your character looked like before you voiced it?
No, they kind of said, I sort of had, they sent like little scraps or, you know, like little, like not scraps, but, you know, like sketches of what it would possibly, the style of the animation. I don't know what you call the style that this particular film is. I find it's a really, really beautiful, to me, older style animation. Like Studio Ghibli. I don't know. It's a beautiful old style, but I had a sort of an idea, but not entirely. And I was thrilled with the outcome. I was like, I wish I looked like Tansy. She's fabulous.
Yes, she's quite John Hind postcard kind of thing. The really russet red hair and the beautiful pale complexion.
Yeah, they said they would allude to all of us. And I think you can kind of see, but it's, you know, it's like, you know, those caricature pictures you get done in Paris. They're not, they don't look like you, but you can see you kind of in there. So I think it's that sort of idea.
Yes. And then there are scenes that are in a kind of more sepia black and white as well.
Yes, which I thought was, I found that part of the movie, without giving anything away, incredibly moving and poignant. And I think it's owed to the fact that it is in that sort of, as you say, sepia black and white. It's beautiful. My husband actually draws graphic novels, and he was incredibly, incredibly moved by how they drew that and how they put it together. And then, it gives it something.
And now the film has got a great start in life, hasn't it? It was included in the Berlin Film Festival, the European Film Awards, Tallinn Black Nights Film Festival, Shanghai International Festival, Chicago International Children's Festival. It's gathering quite momentum.
It is, and you know, thank God, because we made it, I don't know, like 5 or more years ago. And I remember I was talking to Enzo and Roddy at Galway when this, I think they've been working on it for something like 10 years or longer. And I remember when we did the, when we voiced it, I remember Enzo saying, I was like, you know, when might it be out? When could we see it? And he was like, oh, probably like 3 years. And I was like, 3 years? And he was like, that's how long animation movies take. He was like, we're at the start of the process right now, but we have to go on now and draw and, you know, everything that goes into that. And then COVID hit. So it's, I'm just thrilled that it's getting out, because I think it's a beautiful movie that's funny and moving and has a good, strong message. It's a good way to introduce that conversation with your children, I think.
Were you happy that your Peaky Blinders co-star Cillian Murphy got the Oscar recently?
I was so happy. I was stupidly happy, as if, you know, I got it. I just think he's one of our great, great talents. And I'm so happy that he's been like fully, fully internationally recognized, because I think he's something else.
Yes. And Paul Mescal, of course, who you worked with on The Great Gatsby. Yeah.
So, you know, they owe it all to me, basically, all of them.
You because, gave them, you know, some training.
I invented them, Kay. No, I know. I mean, it's a rising tide lifts all boats. So I think it's just great for the country. I think, it's no surprise to any of us that we have that talent. I think anyone in the industry has known that forever and a day. So it's just great that for such a small island, we're getting so internationally recognised.
And Charlene, you've been fairly busy yourself with a new production, a very beautiful production.
Yes, I mean, I think it's an incredibly special and poignant and beautiful production, if I do say it so myself. Yeah, I did. I had a little baby. So I've been kind of out of the loop for a long time now. I've just been in nesting mode and enjoying my little girl. She's very special.
And this is Martha Josephine, and she is just 3 months old. Is that right?
Yeah, just 3 months, and she's already given me chat.
So it must be very parallel for you, the fact that the film you're doing in A Greyhound of a Girl is very much a circle of life.
Yes. Yes, it's been an incredibly interesting time for me. Martha was born in April, and 2 weeks later, I very, very suddenly lost my father. So I am both feet welded in the circle of life right now, the birth of my child and the loss of my father. So it's actually insane that this film is coming out right now. Because he's the biggest Roddy Doyle fan, and he could not wait to see this film. And, you know, it's heartbreaking that he won't now, but it's just crazy that I did a film about grief and it's coming out right in the depths of grief and having a child. So it's a very, very, I guess, existential time.
And I'm sure he was a great Charlene McKenna fan as well, your father.
The biggest. Mortifying. He used to mortify me. So it's, I know. I don't know. I've lost one of my biggest fans.
Well, we're very, very sorry for your loss, but thrilled with the arrival of Martha Josephine. Congratulations. And congratulations on A Greyhound of a Girl, Charlene. And A Greyhound of a Girl is on general release from today. Singer-songwriter Angie McMahon from Melbourne, Australia, released her album Light, Dark, Light Again late last year, and it explores self-reflection and transformation. It follows her breakout debut, Salt, which earned her widespread praise, tour collaborations with Hozier, and being described as a one-woman Fleetwood Mac. Angie's here in Dublin before she heads off to play Glastonbury Festival this weekend. Angie, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, and we're delighted you're going to play live for us here this evening. Your new album, Light, Dark, Light Again, was released late last year. And after that praise that Salt got, your debut album, was it a bit daunting putting your second album out into the world?
It was. It's a classic tale, I think, the second record story. It took me almost 4 years to make it, and I was really just anxious about a lot of things in life. Putting out the album was one of them. And by the time it came out, I was really just happy to be releasing songs, and I didn't know if people would connect with them, but I was putting out what I needed to hear for myself musically and lyrically. And then it was very generously received, which has been wonderful.
Yes, you talk about that anxiety, and even in the title of the album, Light, Dark, Light Again. What's the inspiration behind the album title, and what kind of things were you going through and working through in the album?
I was really working through my mental health. I've had, you know, real struggles with anxiety and depression, among other things, grappling with my own sexuality and my, like, an ADHD diagnosis, and just understanding who I am in the world. And I was getting a lot of comfort and answers from nature when I was making the record. I really landed into the understanding of nature's cycles, and, you know, the way that water comes in and out, tides, and the beginning of every day being a new opportunity for growth and change. And that's really where the title of the record came from. There's a lot of looking at trees and looking at the way that birds are, and finding, I think, myself and my peace in that observation.
And is that the way it started, or is that how it finished? Was there a whole bunch of anxiety and trying to work your way through it at the start?
Yeah, definitely the latter. I was having really big panic attacks and really struggling to find calm in myself. And I did a lot of running, I did a lot of dancing, I did a lot of writing, and then reflecting on it, looking back, the moments of peace really came, in my
I think
nature
you did
time.
A lot of reading as well. You were very inspired into that whole looking at nature as a point of solace through reading.
Yeah, I was. I was doing a lot of reading. I read a lot of Mary Oliver poems. And there's a book called Braiding Sweetgrass, which is a really wonderful book about how to have a relationship with the natural world. And I took a lot from that. And that was really, really helpful for me. And I read a lot about psychology, and I was reading about self-compassion and learning about the brain, the subconscious brain, how we're so mean to ourselves. There was a lot in there.
Yeah, because it comes across in the end as quite a kind album.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I think I really needed that. I needed to look into the mirror and say nice things to myself, and I would go to sit down at the piano and try to write a song and just let whatever I needed come out. And a lot of the time it was, just a positive affirmation or a self-compassion mantra. So I'm glad that comes across. It's nice to be able to sing them and promote the record now, because I still need to hear those things, and maybe other people do as well. So yeah.
Now, the first track we're going to hear is the way a lot of us deal with anxiety, which is called Fireball Whiskey. So it's got something about drinking and a lot about heartbreak. Can you talk us into it?
Yeah, this song is one of the first ones that I wrote for the record, and it is a breakup song, and probably one of my more mature breakup songs. It's called Fireball Whiskey. In the armchair over there, I can see a face in the upholstery. I can get anxiety from an inanimate object, an inanimate object, an inanimate object. My backbone could have grown, but I think it's turned to softness. I think it is a problem, like food that's going rotten. And you might say it's okay to eat it, but then it makes you vomit. I really hate to vomit, except the one time I drank too much Fireball whiskey, 'cause I wanted you to kiss me. So I threw it up, washed my mouth, and sat back out on the couch with you. Sat back out on the couch. I planted My feet and my hands were reaching back for you. Now everywhere I step into, I'm thinking about you fondly, thinking about you fondly, thinking about you fondly. This morning I didn't want to get out of the shower, but hot water runs out and you have to carry on, don't you? Close and move along, don't you? Just like letting go of you, I can't believe I'm letting go of you. I, the one time I drank too much fireball whiskey, I wanted you to kiss me, so I threw it up, washed my mouth and sat back out on the couch, opened up and settled down, learning what we were about, got close enough to pull away, begging all that joy to stay. You were so warm, you were the room I couldn't stay. There was no room, I could love you anytime, I could love you anytime, I cried.
So that was Fireball Whiskey from Angie McMahon's new album called Light Dark, Light Again. And Angie is here with us in studio. You, a few years ago, you gigged with a man from this neck of the woods, Hozier. How did that come about?
Yeah, I did. I give thanks to my booking agent who found me onto that tour. And it was a really wonderful experience. I loved every show that we played. It was about a month touring around the US, and he puts on such a wonderful show and has a really lovely crew. I really fell in love with Irish people on that tour because everyone was so kind and great musicians. It was a great experience.
And you duetted with him on stage.
Yes, he has a wonderful song, Work Song, and he kindly invited me to sing with him, which was a real highlight. Yeah, it was a lovely memory.
You do like these kind of muscular singers. You like people like Bruce Springsteen. You like Bob Dylan.
Yeah, I do. I love a gutsy voice. I love an activist. I love music that speaks to the times that we're in. And yeah, Hozier is a great example of that as well. But yeah, I was raised on Springsteen. My dad raised me on Springsteen's records and Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell. And yeah, they're still some of my favourites.
And when it comes to writing your own songs then, are there songs that you know are going to be these soft songs and then the more rocky songs?
No, not necessarily. There are some songs that start out that soft way, like sitting at the piano, they're a bit more of a ballad, and then by the end I realize that I need to do some yelling and do some moving around to actually release the feeling that's coming up, and so they kind of transform themselves into something maybe a bit more Springsteen-esque.
And this album you recorded in America?
Yeah, I did a lot of it over there, yeah.
So what was that experience? And you worked with people from the Bon Iver school or crew?
Yeah, there's a producer called Brad Cook who's based in Durham over there. It was lovely to be in the nature of North Carolina. It's a very green space, and that was lovely to be able to go and look up at the trees while we were making the record. And Bon Iver's drummer, Matt, lives down the road and played drums on a lot of the songs. It was a really lovely experience. It helped build my confidence in being a producer myself as well. And yeah, I made some of the record at home, but I really wanted to expand my skill set and do something risky and terrifying. And I was terrified, but I went to America by myself without my band. And yeah, I'm really happy with what we ended up with.
And did you find that difficult going into the studio with, you know, with this new crew and, you know, these deeply personal songs where you had been working out a lot of difficult issues and working with these guys? Or were they so welcoming and nonchalant it didn't matter?
Yeah, they were. They were very welcoming. And I mean, it's always scary working with new people. And like you say, it's vulnerable material. But I think one of the big lessons I was learning in the making of this record was that I didn't want to let fear run my life the way that it had been. And so I was really trying to go through the doors and dive into the risky feeling. Every morning before going to the studio, I would do a meditation lying on the floor and just try to be present and challenge myself out of my comfort zone, because I think that's how you make great art. And yeah, it was a good challenge for me, but I was intentionally challenging my nervous system. So that was definitely part of it.
Yes, yeah. You do challenge yourself. In the song Fish, for example, you know, there's a lot of looking at yourself and trying to, you know, give yourself positive mantras. But you also give a hard look at yourself and say you've been a bit mean to other people at times.
Yeah, that was a really important part, I think, of my growth as a person, but also as a songwriter. I have been... When I was younger, I've been tending to just blaming other people for pain, but I think it's been a big lesson for me to take accountability for my behavior. And it's fun to do that in songs because it feels honest and you feel like the song is true, and that feels better to sing, you know, something that is actually painting a true, well-rounded picture of something. So yeah, I prefer to write that way now.
So the next track you're going to play for us is Letting Go, and that's really at the heart of this album. It has those affirmations, those mantra. Talk us into the track.
Yeah, this is one of my more Springsteen-esque songs. It started out as a piano ballad, but it did become something bigger. This is Letting Go. I might have spent 6 months lying on the living room floor. I might have been sick, then well, then sick some more. I might be proud of me than I ever have been. I've been learning about letting go, how to do it without my claws scratching the surfaces. I've been learning about wasting time and closing some doors, hoping to open more down the line. I knew from miles away that I would detonate. I tried some magic tricks to skip my fate. I gave up the ball as a defender. The trick was simply to surrender. I've been learning about letting go, how to do it without my claws scratching the surfaces. I've been learning about wasting time and closing some doors, hoping to open more down the line.
So that was Letting Go from the new album by Angie McMahon called Light Dark Light Again. And Angie is playing Glastonbury. Tell us about your gig in Glastonbury. You're on the acoustic stage.
Yes. And I kind of thought the acoustic stage might be a little back corner tent, in, you know, in the far end of the festival. But people have told me it is quite a bigger stage than I imagined. So I am a little bit more nervous than I was now that I've spoken to some British people, but I am very excited. I've never been to Glastonbury and it's obviously a very big event. So I'm thrilled to be invited and I hope it goes well.
Well, I guess if you're going, you might as well go big.
Yeah, that's it. I might as well experience it from behind the scenes as well. Yeah.
Enjoy the acoustic stage at Glastonbury. Angie McMahon, her album Light Dark Light Again is available now. More details on angiemcmahon.com. If you're not cheek by jowl at the Taylor Swift concert or shenaying your way over to Malahide Castle to see Miss Twain, then stay with us and get our recommendations for new albums. First up, we have the powerhouse pop rockers Imagine Dragons, known for their anthem hits and stadium-filling energy, returning with a brand new, albeit a tad short, album called Loom. Next, we're back in the timeless world of Johnny Cash, where a posthumous collection brings the Man in Black's voice back to life with a rare and unreleased tracks. And finally, we turn to Chanel Trace from Compton, California. He's a DJ, singer and producer and shares his full-length debut, Head Rush. I'm joined by Kate Brennan Harding and Owen Glacken, who have been listening. And we'll start with Imagine Dragons and the album opener, Wake Up. That's Wake Up from Loom, the new album from Imagine Dragons. And as I said, Kate Brennan Harding and Owen Glacken have been listening to our three albums this evening. So Kate, bring us back into the history of Imagine Dragons and a little about their lead singer, Dan Reynolds.
Well, Dan Reynolds is a really interesting guy. And actually, at the moment, TikTok is full of all of his videos. In fact, a lot of people have discovered Dan Reynolds because of TikTok and his energetic bare-chested display in arenas. But he actually began writing music when he was 12 years of age. He had 1,000 songs in his back catalogue when he was about 20. He formed Imagine Dragons in 2008. They released their first album in 2013-2014, and from there, this is their sixth studio album. They are a stadium. They are one of the biggest bands in the world. They're not exactly for everybody, but they are a arena filling, massive.
And now there are similarities with Brandon Flowers of the Killers, because he's from the Church of the Latter-day Saints.
Yes, exactly. And the thing with Dan Reynolds, which is interesting, and he speaks about it on a lot of podcasts, he really struggled with mental health. He really struggled with Mormonism, which is, you know, his family's all Mormon and they were very devout. And he broke away from the church probably about 8 or 9 years ago. He doesn't have any ill will or bad feelings around it, but for him, it was a breakaway freedom, because he couldn't figure out why he couldn't hear the voice of God in his head. And he writes about this in his music, and he writes about it through all of his albums. This is how he's expressed himself. So, you know, he's also an LGBT ally, which in middle America is absolutely massive. I am a fan of him, not necessarily the band, but I think he's got a really interesting backstory, and I think he's very interesting if you listen to him on podcasts. He was on a podcast with an artist called Youngblood for BBC, and it's incredibly good as well if you want to get an insight into him.
So, Owen, Imagine Dragons had a huge hit in 2012 with Radioactive.
Yeah.
And then their sound became very familiar and popular. So how has their sound developed onto Loom that we're listening to tonight?
Well, I feel really bad because Kate makes such a strong argument for this guy being a great guy, and now I'm about to say some unkind things about his latest album. Yeah, so about 10 years ago, well, 2012 was when Radioactive came out, and I remember vividly a friend of mine who runs a recording studio saying, bemoaning the fact that every young band was coming into him saying, I want to sound like Imagine Dragons. That was the template at the time. And I think you can definitely still see that thread in even in people like Dermot Kennedy, that production style of fusing kind of, you know, electronica with more, you know, natural instrumentation. Now, 2012 is, last time I checked my calendar, is 12 years ago, is that correct, Kate?
Yeah.
12 years ago.
It doesn't feel like it.
No, it's 12 years ago, apparently. And this album feels like 10 B-sides from Radioactive that were discarded 12 years ago, and then they found in a drawer and went, let's make an album out of these.
Oh, that's very harsh.
I know it is. Yeah. And I feel really bad. And again, Kate's just speaking so warmly about him, he sounds great, but I don't know the last time I've sat so annoyed by an album. Do you know what it reminded me of? And this isn't being specific about his music, but I remembered walking out of the cinema after seeing the Baywatch remake.
Oh God.
And yeah, and feeling offended, not because of any content or sort of any political statement, but just thinking, is this how lowly the creators of this think of us, that this is what will pass
it's
for
basic,
good.
Yeah.
Anyway, as Baywatch aside, it's unrelenting. The production is overblown. That's their thing. Don't get me wrong. They do these big, huge, sonic, massive sounding records. And that's great. But it's just the biggest problem for me was deciding which fist to punch myself in the face with halfway through every song.
No, we just heard Wake Up there. That's fairly, you know, stock Imagine Dragons, isn't it?
It is. It's the opening. It's the opening song of the album. It's very much Buzz Yourself. I have to say, I think it's so refreshing for me to not be the one that's giving out about something. it's so nice. Again, the album is, if you like Limp Bizkit, if you like Papa Roach, if you like early Eminem, you kind of got a whole mixture of that done in a commercial sphere. But I think in a commercial sphere that does work for its listeners and it's harmless, I think.
OK, let's listen to another one. This is Nice to Meet You.
Anyway, it's nice to meet you. Anyway, it's nice to meet you.
So that's Nice to Meet You from Imagine Dragons' new album, Loom. That's quite boppy.
It's boppy, it's summery, it is harmless. I'm delighted there isn't a man singing that he's actually using consonants and vowels, because so much of the moment we have people singing that just don't actually pronounce their words. So now, are my positives.
Now, there were songs that you didn't like even less than this. Take Me to the Beach was one you picked out, Owen.
Take Me to the Beach is among the lowest of the low points for me. It'll probably be a huge single, but I mean, lines like you take the snow, it's way too cold, and my heart is cold enough. He sing raps, and I've decided to call this technique saps, because he saps a lot in this album. In fact, he saps the life out of me.
I feel Dan Reynolds is safe from your lyricism. All right, let's move on. Stars out of five for you, Kate.
I am giving this 3 out of 5. I think children will love it. I think it's feel good. but I think that's a good thing. And I also think, like, he's a positive role model. I'm more enamoured with him, with Dan Reynolds, than I am with the band Imagine Dragons.
All right. Go on, Owen. Do your worst.
Yeah, apart from an unnerving desire to shop at H&M, this album didn't give me a whole lot. I'll give it 2 stars, okay?
Two and three for poor old Imagine Dragon. But it's very short. It's only about 31 minutes long. So that's Loom, their new album. Next, we have the posthumous album from the man in black, Johnny Cash, called Songwriter. I spoke to his son, John Carter Cash, earlier in the week about how this collection of songs came together. So he found this, well, he knew this collection of songs existed, Owen, but then he decided to work his producing magic on it because John Carter Cash is a producer.
Sure, yeah. So he found, these were demoed around the time that John was about to break ground on American Recordings 1 with Rick Rubin. So these songs were recorded with a band, with instrumentation, even though the American Recordings record went on to be the first one anyway, certainly was totally stripped, just Cash and guitar.
And all written by Johnny Cash. And,
well, the first American Recordings was a mix of original Cash
songs.
No,
I mean this song.
This one is all Johnny, yeah, that which is the whole kind of the beating heart mm-hmm. of the record is that we're listening to songs written by John. And, you know, ultimately, for a lot of people, Johnny's known for his reinterpretations of big rock songs, on the American Recording series, whereas any opportunity to focus in on John's ability to write songs for me is a good time, a time well spent. And here, look, it's they scrubbed the songs, they built them back up again. There are moments where I started to worry, you know, on Drive On, which comes in around track 2 or 3, which is one of the couple of songs that we have heard before. And when we did hear it before, it was just Cash and guitar. Here they add more stuff onto it. At the end, it starts to get into this swampy psychedelia. I almost heard sort of later Oasis in it, in the guitar. And I was like, what are we doing here? Oh, no. But ultimately, the lads in the studio had this mantra of what would Johnny Cash do? And I think ultimately, apart from those kind of little flourishes, which will allow them, because they are quite cool, to be fair, they stuck to that mantra and it feels like a Johnny Cash record.
OK, so let's listen to Hello Out There.
Keyway, sailing, 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 in this final fight.
Hello out there from songwriter by Johnny Cash. That is quite eerie, isn't it? I know he's singing hello out there out, but you also feel he might be singing back to us.
That's exactly what I felt. And it's the opening song on Songwriter. And I think it's very interesting as well. When I was reading about it, it was recorded around, written and recorded originally around the time that Cash appeared on Zaropa with U2. And this is the only song on, on Songwriter that sounds ethereal. And I think it's very cool that they've put it at the very beginning, because it's, you know, for me, I'm like, Johnny's looking at us. He's coming back and he's, you know, like spending time with an old friend. But it is interesting to know, if you go and listen to The Wanderer on Zaropa, you can hear the similarities. So that song does not sound, the rest of the album does not sound like that. This is the only one that sounds that ethereal and eerie.
Yes, but his voice is in fine fettle. I mean, he was obviously going on to greater things around the time he was writing and singing these. So when they came across the cache of songs, they really, the cachet of Cash.
Yeah.
They really fell on luck, didn't they?
Well, they did. And the thing is that originally when I was listening to this album, I was like, okay, so obviously these songs were kind of done in a demo version in around 92, 93. But actually, I didn't realise that most of the songs, there's a whole collection, and they were written over 30, 40 years. Some of them were 30 years old. Some were slightly newer. And you can kind of hear that. So it's more like a meander through lost notes of Johnny Cash. And it's a wonderful collection in terms of seeing how he created songs and how his voice was what people could weave something around.
Okay, well, we'll talk about him as a songwriter in a moment, but let's listen to some of Spotlight.
Single tear inside tonight, Spotlight.
That's Spotlight, from written and sung there by Johnny Cash, and that's from the Songwriter album, with a little help from the Black Keys.
Yeah, Dan Auerbach, the maestro of the blues rock greats, Black Keys, is playing some lovely guitar there. And actually, if that song kind of kept going, Dan comes out a little bit more near the end.
And now that's not overdone.
No, and as I said, there was only that moment in Drive On where I thought, is this what it's all going to be like? But I was so comforted when we got to around the middle point. There's a song called I Love You Tonight, which is just classic country song, and I honestly wasn't expecting the emotional punch that I got from it. I welled up. And I just was lost in the fact that, oh my God, we're listening to a new Johnny Cash album. In the song, he talks about making it through the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s with June. And he wonders, will we make it to the millennium? You know, I think we might, but I love you tonight. And in the song, he talks about, you know, as I say, will we make it to the millennium together? And now we know. Oh, excuse me, there was a line, actually, I wrote it down because I just thought it was gorgeous. He sings, when it's over, I hope we go together. I don't want you to be alone. And as we now know, that they did make the millennium, and that they eventually in 2003 died months apart from each other. And just that just line killed me when I heard it. You know,
same. I actually welled up completely when I was listening to it too, because we all know that they had a stunning love relationship, but that June obviously was put through the ringer by Johnny as well, and yet they held firm. It's like proper human traveling life together, and I really enjoyed that song as well myself.
And do you think there's a consistency in the songwriting on the album?
We see, I don't think you can say consistent, because some of the songs are written at different times of his life. But in terms of the production, I have to say his son has done an amazing job of creating the consistency. And also we must remember that he used guitar players that used to play with Johnny. So we just had the vocals, and then these guitar players that were in Johnny Cash's band creating the music. So it is authentic, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you can hear the ghost of Luther Perkins on the guitar playing. I'm assuming it's Marty Stewart playing.
Yeah.
That gorgeous, you know, old school Telecaster boom chicka, that Tennessee 2 Sun Studio sound. Mm-hmm. So when that arrived, I was just overcome with this sense of, I'm wrapped in a warm blanket, you know. Aww. I've come home. We have a new Johnny Cash album. Oh my God.
Two of us definitely felt like we were having hugs, didn't we?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who needs Shania Twain or Taylor Swift? Just listen to songwriter Johnny Cash. Starts out of 5 from you.
For me, it's 3.5.
3.5. From you, Kate?
I gave it 3 out of 5, but I think I was just being quick with that. I do think it's a 3.5, and I think the story behind it, and, you know, hopefully it introduces more people to the wonder of Johnny Cash.
And finally, we have the debut album from Chanel Trace called Head Rush, which he describes as a transition from me being just a bedroom producer guy to fully becoming this Chanel Trace character. So, Kate, tell us a little bit about him.
Well, he's really interesting because he first released a single in 2018. We have only had two EPs from him, and now today he's released his debut album to huge hype, and the hype goes warranted because for me this album is a broad spectrum of how you can bring a multitude of genres, mix them, blend them, and he does it with aplomb. Now, he would be known as well for appearing on Jungle albums. There's a lot of collaborators on this, from like Ty Dolla $ign to Thundercat, and he's also appeared on those albums too. He's interesting as well. He's from Compton. Compton has a rich hip hop history, and his dad is from Chicago, which has a rich house music history, so therefore I think they both combine. And as a producer, I think he is fascinating. I'm really looking forward to actually listening to much more of this album over the course of the next coming months.
Okay, let's listen to We Hungry Now. If you get back, my friend, I get back, gang. I got on the road to the top, north of Compton, do it for fun, you know what it is. So that's We Hungry featuring Estelle there from Head Rush by Chanel Trace. Owen, we heard Estelle there. What other collaborators does he have on the album, and how does it, you know, lend to this texture that has created all the hype?
Yeah, well, I mean, just there he uses Estelle, but she's quite muted. Mm. She, you know, you would have to know it's Estelle, I think, to realise. But she's used really tastefully, and the same goes for Thundercat, appears on a song called Candy Paint. And Ty Dolla $ign actually is put to good use on one of my favourite tracks, Holy Moly.
It's brilliant.
But yeah, there's a lot of collaboration going on, but it's all sort of just sewn into the fabric of the record. And this is quite clearly the work of a very fervent creative mind. It goes off on all these crazy tangents. It's a little dizzying at times. Head Rush is a really good name for it because you do feel like you need to sit down after it and maybe a Motilium. But it genuinely is part of the genius. You do get the sense that you're listening to a real piece of work. Mm. And it's one of those albums. You sit there and you go, how did they decide in the studio that this was finished?
Yeah.
There's just, you can just see he's just clearly trying to just throw things in. And don't get me wrong, at times there are, like that we just heard We Hungry, but with Estelle, the song before that is a song called Aspen, which is dreadful. But the beauty of this record is that even if there is a couple of moments like that, they're all followed swiftly along by a great bit of music, you know.
Did your head rush?
My head rushed, but in excitement for delving in, because there's an awful lot of layers to each sound. And I love that you could think you're listening to a Detroit house track, and suddenly we're back in hip hop land, and suddenly then this kind of almost like space sequence, and you're sonically just moved around, and maybe it's my ADHD, but I really enjoy that.
Right, and you seem to have enjoyed it very much, John.
Certainly, yeah, I agree with you. It's a journey of a record, you know, but it's clearly the work, as I said, of a bit of a genius, really, and you feel that.
So stars out of five from you, Owen, for Chanel Trace and Head Rush.
I'll give it 3.5 stars.
3.5. And from you, Kate.
So I think it's a really smooth album. I think I'm giving it 4 out of 5. It's brilliant.
4 out of 5. Yeah. Great. So that's Kate Brendan Harding and Owen Glacken. Thank you so much. It was Johnny Cash, songwriter, Loom by Imagine Dragons, and Chanel Trace and Head Rush. The Culcannon. We have got the definitive recipe from Lou. She said, Culcannon in our family was always made with curly kale. The recipe came from my great-great-grandmother. Our family have been Dubs for many generations. Maybe the cabbage recipe is from other parts of the country. Love the show, says Lou. Well, Lou, we'll forgive you for that. Maybe Charlene McKenna and I ate cabbage with our spuds. Anyway, that's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Leah Murphy and Paula Shields. Mark Dwyer was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's show was produced by NASA McLaughlin. John Creedon is next after the news at 8.